I think a lot of people make the mistake to strive for perfection, when they're trying to change, or, they get really discouraged if they don't master something right away. And I just recently realized and figured it out that I made a lot of mistakes. It's going back to kind of goal setting. I made a lot of mistakes in the past where I want to make all these big changes. Everybody makes these changes at the beginning of the year, and most of them fail. They just kind of give up by February, March. And I think that the biggest thing that you can do, the best thing you can do for yourself, is just be easy on yourself. Take one thing and master it.
So good morning, everyone. Welcome back to Time Tested Mastery. I wanted to share with you an exciting interview that we're having today with a name that should be familiar to you. Cassie Winterout, our sponsor that works for M5 Financial. You've heard me give her introduction and her information for the past several weeks as we've gone through this first season of Time Tested Mastery. Now, I want to share with you one of the things that I have told you over and over and over again is that being in this business for 40 years, I've had the opportunity to work with a lot of lenders. Some of them are quite excellent. The reason that we have Cassie on today is that she's one of the finest performers that I have dealt with in my entire career. And we've all, if you're in the real estate business, we've all dealt with people that were less than stellar. So I wanted to welcome Cassie to the show today. And we're going to talk about her philosophy about business and the ways that she's used some of these time-tested principles. So welcome, Cassie.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks for
I
having me.
appreciate you coming to the show. And I mean everything that I shared with you. We've worked with you. My son has worked with you. My daughter and son-in-law have worked with you. And all of them have given you great reviews. I mean, they rave about you.
That's very kind. Your family is wonderful.
A lot of times people will get such a glowing thing, and sometimes it's not necessarily true. And I want to share with our audience that it is true. And so the reason that I wanted to have you on today was I wanted to hear about your journey, your focus, your commitment to this business, and the excellent job that you do. There's got to be steps that got you along the way from where you started to where you are today, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah,
Yes.
absolutely. I mean, we don't start day one from where we are 40 years into our career, and you haven't been in for 40 years, but there's a long journey from when we start to when we achieve that excellence that we're looking for with mastery. So I'm going to ask you to introduce yourself a little bit and tell us sort of the state of Cassie when you got into the lending business. How did it start out for you?
It happened by accident. I was in my 20s and had, was trying to, I had gone to college and I had a degree in anthropology from Western Michigan University, and had realized when I was almost finished with my education that I did not want to go into anthropology as a career. And I was a very highly organized person that was really good at multitasking. So I was looking at a lot of administrative work. And I answered a Monster ad for Monster.com ad for a assistant at a mortgage company. Went in and interviewed, and I ended up being an executive assistant to some higher level management within this mortgage company. It was American Home Mortgage, which is one of the first mortgage companies to implode during the dark days of 2007, 2008. So I was constantly surrounded by the lending world and the lingo, and worked very closely with other loan officers. And it's funny because at that time I was very afraid of the phone, making
Okay.
phone calls, talking
So,
on the
I want to
phone.
go back because I think there might be some interesting story to that part. You go to school for anthropology and you decided that that was not for you. So, what were you expecting that you were going to have to do if you went into anthropology after spending all that time in school?
It wasn't necessarily what I was having to do, you know? I mean, I think my greatest goal was that I would go and work on excavation sites. That was just exciting to me and fascinating, the whole thing. I realized that the community of it wasn't something that I fit into. And back then, I didn't have much confidence. I was kind of aimless. And I would have had to go to school even longer. And at that time, I just wasn't good at school. I hadn't mastered, you know, the art of going to school. Some people, it comes naturally. It just wasn't. If I had to go now, I think I'd, you know, ace it'd be no problem.
Okay.
But I was also working full time at the time, which made it a lot more difficult.
I think what I'm hearing is that you went to school, you were learning something, and you realized that it probably wasn't for you, which I think is, that's a win. You know, that's something good to learn from going to school, right? Is that this is not for me and I'm going to make a change. I think that's a good thing. The other part I heard you say was that you weren't quite the master of the student, the learning process or the growth kind of thing. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. I got into the real estate business by accident. And you got into the mortgage industry by accident. Fascinating that we get into something that we become very successful at, but it wasn't something that we were planning to do our entire lives. It was something new.
I never, you know, as a kid, I thought I was going to be, you know, my dream was to be a book editor. And I knew I needed to go to college, you know, the first person on my dad's side of the family to really go to college. So I had to go to college and, when I first started college, I didn't know what to do. I had no idea what I liked at that time. So I was just kind of taking a lot of English classes and, some business classes, and I thought I would figure it out. And then one of my general electives in my first year, first semester, was an anthropology class. And that really excited me. So I could kind of continue to, and I think it kind of bugged my dad a little bit that I was going into anthropology.
Okay.
So a full steam ahead on that, you know?
So when you made the change, dad was happy.
I don't think he was happy.
He wasn't happy. Okay. So you go to school, you know, get your degree, you decide this is not for me. So you answer a job and you get into lending. And so it sounds like you were in an environment that was pretty dynamic, at least from the learning standpoint. So talk a little bit about how you started and what influenced you early on.
When I first started, it was a whole nother world. I come from part of my family is they're all like in some way part of, you know, in lending or real estate. So I'd worked with my brother a little bit. He owns a part owner in a small business finance company.
Okay.
Now and back then, you know, he was a, you know, commercial lender. And so I did a little bit of work for him after college. And then that was kind of, you know, I could add that to my resume and that helped showing that I'd worked for another lender. So when I started, it was just this whole, it was kind of an extravagant world back then, you know, it was before the lending laws and guidelines that we see today. Lots of big parties, lots of expense accounts, just spending was, you know, and everybody was making so much money. The companies were making so much money and,
wow.
It was just everybody was getting their real estate license. Everybody was getting their loan officer license if they didn't know what they wanted to do. And so I kind of, very shortly after I started, the bottom dropped out of the market. But I just pushed through because my position was very helpful at that time to kind of keep everybody organized and,
I think is important for the listeners that we are, you know, we're talking to that are, you know, that are after personal growth. I mean, one of the things that happens when you're self-employed, and you and I both know this, is that you have unlimited freedom when you become self-employed. and you have the ability to have unlimited income when you're self-employed, but you can't have both. You can't have both. And when I started in the business, you know, it was a pretty flat market, but it grew. And that first time that it grew, it was the market that I experienced was what you were just talking about. Lots of parties, lots of money. You know, everybody was a legend in their own mind. You know, they were, you know, spending money and having parties, and everything was just fine and dandy until the market goes down. And it's, I think Warren Buffett says it, you know, he says, you know, when the market changes, you can figure out who's, you know, who's been swimming naked, you know, when the tide goes out. And that happened to me. And it may not have happened to you in that first downturn, but you watched it happen with other people. So, you know, did that influence the way that you approach the business, seeing that for the first time? Because we all see that the first time when the market goes up and the market goes down, that first time it goes down, we all experience it, I think, the same way.
I didn't have any wrinkles before then. Okay. You know, I remember I got my first forehead wrinkle during that, you know, first year or two. I never used to swear or curse. And after that happened, you know, it's like, it was very stressful. It was a stressful time for everybody. And once we pushed through that period and, you know, we kind of were beginning to grow again and kind of got our footing again as a company, we'd been bought out. Our retail sales had been bought out by IndyMac. And then a year after that, the FDIC came in and shut IndyMac down. And then we became part of Prospect Mortgage. And during that time, I got really into what the loan officers were doing. You know, we had the weekly sales meetings that I would sit in on and potentially organize if there was like a slide deck. We would get deep into goal setting. And so I kind of got, you know, through like osmosis, I was just absorbing all of that. And I was listening to the other loan officers around me on the phone. And I just eventually was like, I can do this, you know. I can certainly do this. And so I just eventually worked towards getting my license.
Yeah. And how long did you do that?
Probably like 7 years.
Okay.
And then I moved into onboarding with a smaller.
Okay. So, and I think that's, you know, a good thing for people to hear is that, you know, 40 years ago, there were no real estate teams that I was aware of 40 years ago. Everybody did their own thing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when I got hired, they said, you know, there's your desk, there's your phone. I'll see you at the sales meeting on Friday. I mean, that was about as much direction as I got from the broker that I worked for the first time. And my training was listening to the people around me and whatever advice they gave me. And what I learned, you know, from that first year or two is the people that had the most time to give you advice were the people that were doing the least amount of business and were probably not doing it as well as the people that didn't have time for that. But I digress. So, you know, your experience, that success, I think having a 7-year apprenticeship is similar to what I share with new agents coming into the business now is that it's so difficult to get started. If you can become part of a team, that apprenticeship is very, very valuable. You know, would you agree with that?
Absolutely. Okay. Yes. And it kind of, I call it like training wheels, you know, you got training wheels on. If you start out and you're joining a team, it's a great way to do it.
Yeah.
And I started as an assistant, a loan officer assistant. So kind of like a loan processor, you know, with the Furrows and Wagner team.
Okay. And that's where I met you. Ago. You were working with Lanny when I first met you.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Very good. So talk about the transition. You know, what I heard you say was that you were exposed to all the thing that the mortgage loan officers were doing and hearing. Mm-hmm. You recognized that you can do it. So, you know, what was it like to transition into that?
It was definitely a learning curve. You know, being client facing. So before I would think of my clients when I was an executive assistant, my clients were the loan officers or the, you know, the management,
right?
The VPs that I was supporting. And then my clients became like real people, you know, everyday people. And so very quickly, I learned that the best way to succeed was to kind of put myself in their shoes, empathy, practicing empathy without allowing emotions to get into it, because it can be a very emotional business. It's the biggest financial transaction of people's lives for many people.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's very, you can feel very exposed during the process as a buyer, or a seller. And, I realized that I need to put myself on anybody's level, you know, and just kind of, I wanted them to feel like I was in it with them.
Yeah. Well, you know, for lack of a better term, I don't know that I've ever run into a loan officer that has a better bedside manner than you do.
Thank you.
Real estate transactions are stressful, not only for the clients, but real estate agents, which I'm one, and, you know, and I work with them all the time. They, you know, they tend to blow everything up and everything's a crisis. I mean, most people, you know, have a lot easier job identifying problems and complaining about them than they do in solving them. And looking back, I don't recall ever a time experiencing you doing the freak out that everybody else is freaking out and you're saying, okay, well, here's an option, you know, let's try this, or, you know, I've got this option. And, you know, that's something that I saw you do consistently over and over and over again when there was, you know, a challenge to a transaction. And there's always a challenge to a trend. Every single one's got its bumps, but you always approached it the same way. So how did you learn that skill, or how did you develop it?
I don't know that it was like a necessarily super conscious thing. I felt like as long as I can remain calm and have solutions, it makes people feel better about what's happening, and trust, establishing trust, mm-hmm. which is like one of the most important things that you can do. I think that, you know, there's like, I've been, you know, I read a lot for business and self-improvement. And there was this book that I just finished. It's called The Full Fee Agent. And it talks about how there's tactical empathy and then there's sympathy. And empathy is being able to understand and relay, you know, your understanding to a client or the realtor, which is also very important, in the process as well, keeping the agents happy. And then there's sympathy, where you let your emotions enter the room, and that's your emotions have no place in this situation, even though this is my income and this is how I make money.
Yeah.
That kind of comes second or third to how the client feels.
So we've talked a little bit about your start, and there's problems and there's different failures and things that we experience along the way. You know, can you share, you know, your ideas on failure and how that's an opportunity to improve what you're doing?
Yeah. So, I mean, in a broader sense, every single situation, every single event is an opportunity, whether it's good or bad, because it gives you this moment of clarity,
mm-hmm.
so hopefully, you know, sometimes, and it just gives you that opportunity to correct whatever happened that went wrong. There's so many things that happen that are just out of our control. Right. But I think that the way that we handle those situations means everything, especially, you know, to our clients and our partners, you know, working with realtors like you.
Can you give an example of something that was a problem or a perceived failure in a transaction, or maybe even a business relationship, that ended up being an opportunity for growth? And, you know, and I'll share, you know, one with you is that, you know, there was a business merger that I was involved with or was planning to do. back, I think it was around that same time, 2007, you know, 2007, beginning of 2008, and the deal blew up. And I was really angry and I was really resentful over it. And, you know, I got emotionally involved in the deal, which you should never do. And then I found out over the next 2 or 3 years that God gave me the best possible blessing in the world for not making that transaction work. Sometimes you don't know that, you know, God's taking care of you, or that, you know, the solution that everybody thinks is the right solution is not the right solution. And as long as you stay open to moving forward, you will find out that you got a better outcome by sticking with it. I mean, I don't know if that's a good example for something that you've experienced, but do you have any stories like that?
I know you asked me that previously, and it was kind of hard for me to think of anything. I feel like I make tiny failures every single day, all day. And my goal is to make sure that nobody sees that. And so, I mean, luckily, you know, I don't think I've ever made a huge mistake that's blown up any kind of a transaction.
Right.
But I'm very hyper aware of my actions and how they affect the whole process for somebody. So I think I've seen other people, you know, that maybe don't set expectations up front. The biggest thing you can do is just when when I'm talking to somebody and I'm asking them questions and, you know, our pre-qualification
right
process, which is usually like a 20-minute conversation mostly, which seems like a short period of time, but I get a lot of information during that time because I ask these very specific questions every time, is during that process, I can identify what potential pitfalls may come up right in advance. And I let them know, this is something that could trip us up, and this is how we need to deal with it up front so that there aren't any surprises down the road. And I think there are a lot of lenders that don't do that.
There's a lot of real estate agents that do that too.
Yeah.
You want to look at houses? I'll be right out there. That's not a good pre-qualifying script, I tell you. I want to sell my house. What price?
I know. It's like, I think sometimes desperation, for lack of a better word, I think desperation kind of enters the room sometimes, because in between each transaction, we're unemployed. Mm-hmm. So in order to feed our families and pay the bills and keep the lights on, you know, there can be this air of, they call it, was it commission breath?
Commission breath. Yes. Yes, absolutely. So, you know, pre-qualifying is, you know, a skill that sales trainers teach. Real estate salespeople do it to varying degrees. And I would say more often than not, they don't do a very good job of pre-qualifying. So, you know, share, and I know that you ask pretty specific questions because I've been through the process myself, and I know that you've helped my family members who had difficult situations and went through all the way through, you know, what's going on with this, what's going on with this, what's going on. And so you would basically do what a doctor does, which is, I'm going to operate on you, but I have to do all the tests first to know where to operate on you. And that's the way that I look at pre-qualifying. So that, it sounds like that's what you're doing. Talk a little bit about that process, if there's main categories that you're looking for, and how do you identify a red flag? Not necessarily that's probably not the right question. How do you identify it? Is that with your experience, you know by the answer they give you that there's a potential problem there. Right. I mean, that's how you know, it's your experience that tells that. So sort of give an example of a problem that you might identify in pre-qualifying and how you would prepare the borrower to deal with that.
Well, there's the main categories that we ask specific questions under are assets. You know, where's the money coming from? What do you have in the bank? Are you getting a gift from a family member? Do you need down payment assistance? credit is a huge one. if I'm asking someone what they think, I'll always ask, what do you think your credit score is? What do you, do you have any, late? And they tell me, oh, well, my credit's in the 600s. So then that leads me to ask more questions. Do you have any late payments? Do you have any, do you pay your credit cards off each month or do you carry balances? And then the more questions that I have asked, the bigger picture I can get. Some people, if I talk to somebody and they don't know what their credit score is, that's kind of a flag. Most people know what their score is. They have a kind of a good idea of what it is. And so then at that point I would need to, I'll say, well, let's do a soft credit pull just to see what things look like there. Income, what's your income like? Are you, because some people just think, well, this is how much I made last year and that's my income. But there's so many different types, ways that people are paid, and loan guidelines are very specific around those, calculating the income for those different types of income sources.
So one of my red flags is people that won't answer the questions. How do you handle that?
That won't answer the questions. I don't think I've really encountered somebody that won't answer my questions. That's great. It sounds like that happens.
To tell somebody that you've had a bankruptcy, to tell somebody you're going through a divorce, to tell somebody that, you've lost your, all of these different things that can possibly come up. I mean, it's private, and unless you really know someone, the question is, how do you get them to tell you the truth?
Okay.
About those kinds of things.
I think it's just my approach. I, do a little bit of chit chat in the beginning, kind of, try to make it into more of a conversation. And I kind of prep them. I say, is it okay if I ask you a few questions about, your income and your credit and stuff? And if I see some resistance, that's when sometimes I'll just move on. And then I say, then I need some documentation, or, maybe I'll circle back and ask the question a different way.
Okay.
Or I'll ask a different question that maybe will help get me that answer that I was looking for.
That's a pretty specific technique when you're getting resistance from someone. And we get that people are uncomfortable talking about something. And if you push harder on them, they push back harder. And if you push harder on them, they push back harder. And then all of a sudden you have no relationship with them. So it sounds like when you recognize that you're backing off, and maybe, approaching it from a different way or asking it in a different way later, to get you, that information's there, so you need to get it, but you're finding out, instead of a direct attack with it, you're going and finding it another way. Make sense?
Yep.
Okay. Very good. So you've been in the business long enough to see a lot of change. Okay. How do you manage change?
I look at it as another opportunity for growth. I think it was Stephen Hawking that says intelligence is the ability to change, the sign of intelligence. And there are definitely, I don't love change. We all get kind of comfortable in our routines and our processes, but I know that our industry, mine, is constantly changing. The guidelines are changing. The loan products are changing daily.
Okay.
And I watch the stock market as well. And that's just, that changes by the moment. So, if we don't embrace it, it's just, there's no other option but to fail. And it's not a good failure. I think you get left behind if you don't embrace the change. There are definitely some basics to our businesses that should stay. But being able to kind of grow around that is very impactful for staying afloat, staying relevant.
You mentioned that you read a lot of business books. Mm-hmm. How do you decide what you're reading next?
Mostly word of mouth. you know, I'm just chatting with people, with maybe with realtors, what are they reading? Co-workers, we have a like a book club. Mm-hmm. I say that term loosely, right. Book club with some with other loan officers at my company. And we talk about it weekly. And we usually we're trying to read a book a month.
Okay. Very good. Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that, you know, my wife says about me is that, you know, I'm good for about, you know, 6 months or 2 years. There's a window there and I change things purposely. I mean, it's not typically a reactive thing. It is, and I don't know whether it is a boredom or an itch. I'm not sure exactly what it is, but I mean, I'll like clean my office out, reorganize my, I'll move my workspace or, I'll do something different. And, you know, to me, you know, and to most people that I know is that, you know, if you're not growing, you're actually falling behind because the market is always changing and the skills are always changing. And, you know, technology is always changing and your competition is always trying to improve. And so if we're not improving, we're absolutely getting behind. So, so it sounds like books are, you know, a big thing for you.
Mm-hmm. I just have to be aware. I guess awareness just for me personally, we're, you know, I get emails every single day from all the loan investors that I have access to. So mm-hmm. as a loan broker, I have access to like 20 different lenders for different things. And so we get emails from them, you know, daily, weekly, and just trying to be on the lookout for those changes. I follow certain people on social media.
Okay.
That, you know, that help and they kind of come up with these new ideas or new,
okay.
ways of thinking.
I sort of think that's where I was going with it is that there are sales trainers, there's motivational speakers, there are influencers in every industry. There's personal coaches, there's mastermind groups. I think one of the things I love the most is that mastermind groups are actually sort of the best thing because if you go to a trainer and there's 2,000 people there with the trainer, everybody walks out with the same information. That means that you're not unique. But when you're in, you know, with a core group in a mastermind group of people that are really creative and solving problems and they share it amongst a small group of people, then you might have 10 or 15 people, you know, that leave, that go back to their own marketplaces, their own businesses, their own company, and they're doing things that are unique and none of their competition is doing it, if that makes sense. What is your creative process with the emails that you're getting from your investors that say, well, we're going to do this now, we're going to do that now, or we've got this problem coming up? You have to find a solution for it. So how does that look like?
Well, there's so much information that we can't, you know, I just don't have it all in my head. So I kind of just try to keep an idea of which loan investor likes what or which loan mm-hmm. investor does what. And then when I have a scenario, you know, then I just start picking up the phone and making phone calls to different loan investors and just kind of give them some bullet points on what I'm looking at and, you know, can you do this? Mm-hmm. And is it a benefit to the client? And if I don't feel good about it, I, you know, make another phone call or two or three or four until I find the right fit. Okay. And then we actually have, so weekly there's about four of us that show up in this Zoom meeting with other lenders in my company. And we talk about, you know, what are we working on? What have we discovered? You know, what pain points have we discovered about X system at this lender? You know, maybe this type of loan scenario came up and where should I send it? Who should I talk to? So just constantly talking about what we're working on with counterparts is helpful. Okay. If you're not on the phone talking to other people that do the same thing as you, you're kind of on an island. You're not really going to know what's going on. It's really important to share ideas, like you said, across.
So it doesn't sound like you have a formal mastermind group, but with that, the four people that get on Zoom, is that sort of a formal kind of mastermind group, or is it?
It's, you know, it's formal slash informal.
Okay. Okay. And the most curious people that talk to everybody are the ones that usually get the most input. So the creative process then for you, you know, to problem solve is really collaborating with your peers, the people that you trust that are successful.
Exchanging ideas.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Problem solving together. Mm-hmm. So we haven't talked about your goal setting process or the goals that you've set yourself. Do you have a huge major goal that you're chasing right now that's exciting?
I have so many. A huge major goal, it's an ongoing goal, and it's making sure. So the way that I, there's so many different ways, and I've tried all these different options. And I think each year I kind of change up the way I do my goals. But I always kind of fall back on this one, and it's just dividing it up into the four F's, and it's family, fun, finance, and fitness. So family is always number one, and that's always like, that's my why, that's my driving force. And I have my, you know, I have my 5-year-old Jake. Mm-hmm. And, the biggest goal that I have in life is just to make sure that I'm present for him. And in our industry, it's very difficult to be present.
Right.
Because it's not a 9-to-5 job. So my biggest goal is when he gets older is for him to be like, yes, my mom was always paying attention to me.
Right.
You know, my mom wasn't constantly on her phone or on her computer. And then I guess that's like a long-term goal. I guess short-term, right. I really want to be able to take, Trevor and I to, on a big like trip to Europe, you know, Scotland or Spain.
Okay.
Last year we went to Ireland and it was amazing. And it may be a little unrealistic to try to do a trip like that every year, but it, you know, at least every year and a half, I would love to do that.
Yeah. Well, that's a great thing. So, mm-hmm. You know, that's a perfect lead in to one of the questions, you know, is that I have a soft spot in my heart, you know, for moms, you know, single or not, you know, and you're happily married with Trevor and, but it is still very, very difficult to manage both, the professionalism and the commitment to your clients when, you know, the truth is family does come first. So what things have you put into place to make sure that you protect both of those?
Well, this year, one of my goals is try to just be more available for business. Because in the past, I was really focusing more on family, and especially in off hours and weekends. And I probably lost some business just because I couldn't, you know, I didn't have the capacity to answer the phone at 5:30 on a Friday. You know what I, it was just too much because my wonderful son is very high energy. So he takes full attention. If I stop paying attention to him for a minute, it's, you know, it's a problem.
Yeah.
But now that he's getting a little bit older, we've got him, you know, on a really good schedule. And I, you know, I leverage my husband too, who works with me as well. Mm-hmm. I kind of leverage him and I try to really just plan ahead. I try to make sure I'm calendaring as many things as I can. If it's the first time I'm talking to someone, I really need that to be an appointment. It's very difficult for it to be, you know, on the fly. If it's during the day, it's a little bit easier. If someone calls me and I'm, you know, I'm at a point where I can, you know, chat with them for a little bit, then that works. But I think it's important to schedule it. So if somebody needs to speak to me in the evening, you know, that's great. I can absolutely handle that. I just need to have it set up in advance and make sure that Trevor's available to, you know, cover for me and keep Jake out of the office,
yeah.
Our home office while I'm talking.
Time, you know, time management and balance. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't grow up with the work-life balance. So, I'm not a poster child for that at all. But one of the things that I'm fascinated with now is that I'm hearing a lot of people that talk about uninterrupted work time. And they're, you know, they make, you know, blocks of time where, you know, there's no notifications from their phone. There's no incoming phone calls. There's no checking email, no text. There's they have a list and they go through their work for a certain period of time. And then they return the calls after. And the people that seem to be doing that swear by it. You know, they absolutely swear by it. I've always been pretty good about at least having the desire to compartmentalize, you know, to work here and then to be off and to work and to be off. As salespeople, we violate that, you know, a lot. You've seen that in the industry. A lot of people violate, you know, the off switch on their work life. But it's particularly challenging for moms. So let's talk about your mindset. You know, any particular tools that you learned over the years that have helped you with your mindset?
Going back to just reading and just gathering as much information, the more prepared that I feel for any type of situation, the easier it is. So just constantly learning, not getting comfortable in my processes, you know, going mm-hmm. back to that change
right.
aspect. Just preparedness is...
It sounds to me like you don't have to work too hard at being good at your job. That's what it sounds like to me. Or it's like, I just do it.
It's an evolution. It's a constant. And I have days where I just feel like I don't know anything. To be candid, I just feel like I have no idea what I'm doing. But I think that's... Everybody just has days like that, and it's totally mm-hmm. normal. But I think compartmentalizing is really important, and just keep the self-talk positive,
mm-hmm.
And kind of keep it to yourself. You know, I think I was mentioning to you, the more you spread it around, the
yes.
more it gives that thought and those feelings power. So I really try, I keep like maybe a couple people really close to me where if I need to vent, I'm going to vent. But I do try to turn it into something constructive where right. it's just looking for more information to solve the problem or to feel better about what's going on with my day. I think it's like it might be kind of like an OCD thing where I really need, if there's a problem, I need to solve it.
Okay. Okay. So and you had mentioned that, and I think that was one of my observations in dealing with you over the years whenever there were things going on, is that you always seem, you know, you might have been like the duck that's got, you know, feet are flapping, but, you know, above the water, you were doing just fine and, you know, working towards a solution. Okay, so you do need to vent sometimes.
Of course.
Okay.
Of course.
Yeah. But you keep it tight, you know,
mm-hmm.
yeah, to where it'll be constructive.
And there's a switch that I will flip, you know, if there are some days where I can't, I'm mentally maybe drained or I didn't get enough sleep the night before, or, you know, something like that. So I'm not operating at, you know, full strength. And so I just have to trick myself into, you know, and flip that switch in my brain. You know, if I get a phone call, you know, from somebody that needs my mm-hmm. full attention, it's not about me anymore. It's about what value I can provide to them. And I need to be at my best
right.
to do that.
And so you have a switch that works for you.
Mm-hmm. Usually.
Yeah.
Usually.
Yeah, that's it. You know, I can play the role of a salesperson. I can play the role of a coach. I can play the role of all those things as long as I'm okay here. But when I'm not okay here, I don't have the ability to do that. You mentioned exercise. That was one of your fitness things. Does that really fit into your stress management?
Oh, so much. Yes, I have to exercise, get some. I mean, I get movement every day, mostly. I mean, there are some days where I just kind of take a rest day. But I have to get a workout in most days. Sometimes it's just a walk.
Yeah.
Around the neighborhood. And then it kind of takes my, it also takes my mind off of things because, or it takes my mind off of work stuff or family stuff or any other thing. And then I'm just concentrating on my health, you know,
Right.
for an hour.
Well, I understand Trevor's got a big event coming up to where he's doing a fundraiser. What do you do for exercise?
A lot of yoga.
Okay.
I don't know if you knew this. I'm a certified yoga instructor as well. It's part of my fun
that's
and
where that's where the
fitness.
Peace comes from. Absolutely.
And I really like lifting weights, and that's kind of like the main. I have a Peloton. We got that during the, you know, the lockdown when everybody was, you know, cutting out their gym memberships. We got a Peloton, and that's been really great. Very helpful.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Well, it's been wonderful talking with you today. You know, I love everything that you do with your business, and I wish you well going forward with what you're doing. Why don't you take a moment to share any final thoughts that you have with the listeners about what has made you successful, and then also leave them with a way to reach you. And I'll make sure that that information also gets into the show notes so they can reach out to you directly.
I think that we're always just a work in progress. And I think a lot of people make a mistake to strive for perfection, you know, when they're trying to change, or, you know, they get really discouraged if they don't master something right away. And I just recently realized and figured it out that I made a lot of mistakes. It's going back to kind of goal setting, made a lot of mistakes in the past where I want to make all these big changes. You know, everybody makes these changes at the beginning of the year and most of them fail. You know, they just kind of give up by February, March. And I think that the biggest thing that you can do, the best thing you do for yourself, is just be easy on yourself. Take one thing and master it. It, you know.
So tell me a little bit about your ideas on the impact of loss.
Well, there's this comes from a study. This isn't like my own, this isn't my own thing. And it goes back to, you know, basically humans are irrational. So there's this thing called prospect theory, where and it means that people evaluate, humans evaluate loss and gains unevenly. When someone thinks of losing $100 and they also think of gaining $100, the thought of losing that $100 is much more powerful than that gain. So the way that we can use that in our business is to kind of rephrase questions that we ask. So okay. We want to look for no answers. We want to look for negative answers. Like in the past, you know, if I would follow up with someone, I would say, how's your home search coming along? Are you still in the market to buy? But now if we shift that to, have you given up on buying a home? If it's somebody that, you know, maybe I followed up with them a couple times and they haven't responded, I'm going to push that out to them. Have you given up on buying a home? And that will elicit this response where they need to set me straight because they don't want that to be a no answer. They don't want to give up on that. It's all like psychological. Everything that we do and say is psychology. It's prospect theory. It's part of prospect theory. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And which means that people are statistically more likely to act to avert loss than to achieve an actual gain.
Good. Are you already seeing results to it?
It does work.
It does work. Okay.
Yeah, I haven't had to use it that much, but it does work. And then there's, you know, there's another one. If you call somebody and you're, and this comes from, this is part of that full fee agent book that I was talking about. It's this, if you call someone and you say, is this a good time? That's a little bit different because sometimes they just say, no, it's not a good time.
Right.
If you shift that to say, is this a bad time? they don't want it to be like their brain automatically isn't going to respond that it's a bad time because they don't want to say that it's, yes, this is a bad time.
Okay. Well, there's the benefit of the entire interview right there, because I ask that question all the time. Did I catch you at a good time?
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm going to change it. Hopefully this is not a bad time. Is this a bad time? And they'll say no. And I was like, great. I get to keep on going.
There's a lot of different, speculations about how long it takes to create a habit.
Yeah.
I just say 30 days. Some people say it's 18 days. Some people say it's 200 days. I think if you can just put focus into one change, master it, get comfortable with it, move on to the next thing, and you just kind of build on that. And don't be upset with yourself. If you mess up one day, just try again the next day. Every day is a new day for opportunity.
But if you're going to succeed, you're going to fail. And the more you succeed, the more you're going to fail. That's for sure.
Mm-hmm. So, and failure's good. It's okay.
Yeah. As long as you learn from it. Yeah.
Exactly. It's a learning moment.
Great. Well, share with everybody how they can reach you. And I'll leave you with that.
Okay. Well, again, my name is Cassie Winterode. I am the Friendly Lender. And I'm licensed to do home loans in California, Idaho, Washington, and Texas. And I'm adding on to that list this year. The best way to reach me is by cell phone, 858-999-1778. My email address is cassie@cwfriendlylending.com.
Thank you so much, Cassie. It was great having you on today.
Thanks for having me on today, Mark. It's an honor. I really, really enjoy working with you and your team.
All right. Have a great day.
Thanks. You too.